Today, much is made of the problems of our society. It is my humble opinion that the best possible solution that we can reach for these problems lies in the attraction to public service, men of the proven caliber of our speaker today. Charles Percy has proven throughout his entire career that he is a man of intellect, of action, of integrity. His record throughout his career, from the highest honor to be accorded a University of Chicago student, that of University Marshal, to being president of Bell and Howell at 29, to his rapid rise to the forefront of the political arena, is truly phenomenal. I know that you can fill in that part of his background that I have not included here. It is truly outstanding. And for us to draw a man such as Senator Percy with his tremendous schedule is really something. He left Chicago at something before 6:30 this morning to be in Springfield, to be in Champaign, to be back to Chicago, to get to Dallas, Texas tonight for a speech, to be in Houston, Texas tomorrow, and back to Washington tomorrow night. I wonder, as I recite that, if perhaps when we have a man of this caliber, we shouldn't preserve him a little better than that. I guess it's not interjecting politics into this meeting to say that I, for one, am a tremendous fan of Chuck Percy, and I don't know when I have had an honor that I am as appreciative of as the one to present him to you at this time.
Dick Caldwell and Warren Page, Dean Evans, Sister Alexia, Mr. Rogers. I'm very honored to be here. I could not be here last night to see these fine awards presented because the schedule yesterday was a busy one. I had my 49th birthday, and we celebrated it all day yesterday. And I had my last birthday cake at 2:30 this morning when we came home from opening the opera in Chicago. So I'm awfully happy we didn't have cake for lunch today. I'm not sure what role I appear here in today. Ray Page called me and asked if I would be here, and I didn't bat an eye. I said, yes, I'd like to be, because I feel I should report to you as a legislator. I really wanted to be here, I suppose, essentially as a father, because that's our first responsibility. And also, I think, in a sense, certainly as a university trustee, I've tried to serve two universities in that category, the University of Chicago and Caltech. But also, I hope, as a teacher, because truly I believe that a politician, if he's worth anything, has to be a teacher. He has to hope he knows enough and can learn enough to be able to teach. I look on politics and public life as the greatest adult education program, unorganized or disorganized, in the country. We have available to us mass media, unbelievable proportions. And I really sometimes think, as Irwin Canham once said, it's better to send one good thought by tom-tom than all the trash and trivia that goes out over the great television network. I gave my 12th or 15th or 25th, I'm not sure what it was, interview, University of Illinois educational station at the airport when I came in. I've always enjoyed working with CBS and NBC here. And always in Champaign, they seem to have reporters that like to probe and dig a little bit deeper than just a quick, fast headline. I've gotten in trouble every time I've come on this campus. But also, I speak to you as a future teacher, because my life pattern that my wife and I have developed is that having finished 25 years in business, we hope to give some 20 years to public service, and then we both are absolutely avowed to do something in the area of teaching, having hoped by then I'd know enough to be able to teach. And I can't imagine any better way to finish a career than to try to share whatever knowledge we have with young people. And I was thrilled when Paul Douglas, who was my professor 25 years ago and a great inspiration to me, I didn't show it, my gratitude very, very well. But that's politics, I guess. But I was thrilled when he took up again the profession of teaching, because he has so much to share. I also had, last night when the Republican Party adopted its platform, a great pleasure of seeing once again both of our parties address themselves responsibly to the problems of education. And I think the Republican platform, I haven't looked as detailed as the Democratic one, but I think this platform, which starts out by commending Ray Page, is on unassailable ground when it does that. It was a nonpartisan acclamation to his achievements in the field of education. But I do feel that so much has been done under Ray to emphasize the role of education in the state of Illinois. I know when I ran for governor in that unsuccessful quest, and something happened to me on the way to Springfield, one of the pledges that I made was that we would raise state support of education 30% in my first year. Now, that was looked upon as a pretty wild pledge, that no administration had ever in the history of Illinois ever undertaken that kind of a pledge, and I made it public. And I know when we lost and I sat down with Ray and we talked about what we could do anyway in the legislatures, the first day of the legislature opening, the Republican-dominated Senate put a bill in to call for a 30% increase. Democrats came through and called for a 32% increase. And we fought it out, and in the spirit of compromise, we compromised at 31%. And that became the biggest educational bill we've ever had. And last night, the Republican Party adopted a pledge simply saying that you cannot depend upon the support of education in our state for just local property taxes. 70% of them already go to education. There's not a lot of leeway, and those taxes are getting oppressive at the local level. So we must assume a greater degree of responsibility at the state level and get us up in Illinois somewhere near the national average. We're not even close right now to state support for education. And that means we need money. And I was delighted that the Republican Party again, and both parties responsibly, called for revenue revision and left open how we were going to raise that revenue, because we have great needs. And also, I do believe that revenue sharing is one of the first bills I put in the Senate last year, and we've now implemented it in two areas. Revenue sharing with the federal government back to the states, unrestricted grants to the states. And with the now climate for educational spending in Illinois at the best level I've ever seen it in my 48 years in the state, I think when we share that revenue, as I feel positive we will begin somehow next year, even if modestly, a large proportion of that revenue sharing from the federal government back to the state government will go into the field of education, and both parties are on record now that that should be accomplished. So I do feel that these platforms that propose to support certainly our studies in higher education, the study of the Board of Higher Education, to implement our junior college program and so forth, are a great step forward, and I'm proud of the role that our party has played in this area. I'd like to comment on a subject that you know far more about than I do, student unrest. I'm trying to understand it, because it is a phenomenon that's not just in our country or on our campus here or Columbia. It's in Mexico. It's in every country that I've visited in recent years, including communist countries. And it's a little hard to condemn student unrest at home just blanketly and say they should be apathetic and go back and not care the way some of us did in our generation, and then laud to the skies the students that stood up against the communist tanks that came in from the Soviet Union and were the bulkhead of resistance that just aroused Czechoslovakia, that they weren't going to go back to the slave-type economy they had before. And the courage of young people to stand up against the status quo and say, we've got to find a better way of doing things, that same courage exists in the hearts and minds of American students. And we have to find a way to encourage constructive discontent, just as some of the best things we've ever done are because we just became angry about the way something was going and you and I decided to do something about it. I know the best thing I ever did in the Congress so far is my anger at public housing and what it has done to this country. And the thrill I had in conference in supporting the measure that now has made it illegal for us to ever again construct a high-rise public housing project for families. It can never be done in the history of this country again, I don't think. But for 30 years, that kind of public housing has been the so-called panacea. Why, it's created many of our urban problems. Much of our delinquency, our dropouts, by huddling together all the failures. And if they succeed, their reward is eviction from public housing. That concept was so bad that it only was anger on my part and many others that brought a bill that now gives homes for low-income people rather than just public housing. And what a difference eventually that concept is going to make. And so I say, let's take a good look at our students. Let's absolutely condemn destruction and violence in the pursuit of power. The kind of violence that went on in a few rooms here, whether it's white power, black power, or student power, you simply cannot condone such actions in a democratic society. And certainly that destruction that went on 2.5 weeks ago has blackened the eye of the University of Illinois across the country as the stories were so distorted as to what actually went on. And yet we know that property was destroyed in the Illini Union. And whether that destruction is the work of students or outside agitators, whether their complaints were valid or not, at the same time that we condemn such actions, I think we should try to learn from this experience and from those at other campuses around the country. I was most interested in the editorial reaction of the Illini to see what the Daily Illini would say about it. Talking about protesting students, they said this: the protesting students ran into a problem which students have run into time and time again. Administrators will not act when the students merely talk. It usually takes some show of student power to force administrators into action. And I suppose you could go back to some of the rioting. Dick Gregory tried to explain it. He said, you know, we've been talking for 15 years in Chicago about trying to get the water hydrants turned on in the summer, and the police come turn them off, 100-degree temperature, and they won't turn the water hydrants on so the kids can get cool. And then they had a riot, and he says, you can't step around without falling in a swimming pool now. They're building them so fast. Well, what is the conclusion to be drawn then? Do you have to riot to get attention? What a terrible distortion of our society if that would be the conclusion you'd have to come to. So we'd better really listen to legitimate complaints. And I wouldn't try to judge whether the complaints were legitimate or not. And I wouldn't try to confine my comments to any one campus. But I do feel that as educators, I think as administrators, as trustees, as superintendents, as principals, we simply have to find and read the message that's there for all of us to hear. Let's open the lines of communication with our students and find a way to listen more attentively and draw them in and make them a part of the planning that affects their lives so deeply. We're going to be debating next year very seriously whether we give the vote to the 18-year-old or not. And if we do, and an overwhelming body of support now exists for that, the majority and the minority leader and the President of the United States and all the presidential candidates have said they favor it, if we give the student the right to select the President of the United States, the Commander-in-Chief of the Army and the Navy, and all of the legislators, and all of our governors, and they'll have a huge vote when you consider the number of millions that will be brought in, then isn't it time that we start thinking in terms of giving those same students the power and the right and the obligation and the duty to address themselves to other things that more definitely affect their own immediate lives than even some of the more remote national and international problems. I would say that the Congress of the United States hasn't listened to people on many occasions. We haven't listened to the American public. I know I stood alongside Teddy Kennedy 6 months ago and fought hard for gun control legislation. Now here's Sears Roebuck and Montgomery Wards had already voluntarily said they should not ship mail order shotguns, so that a child, and just in a test case, we had an 18-month-old child ordered by mail order just 3 or 4 weeks ago, a submachine gun, hand grenades, and 300 rounds of ammunition. And it was delivered to the 18-month-old child. Now, how long can we carry this on when mentally deficient, when convicts and juveniles can order this kind of armament? And yet, we got only 29 votes on the floor of the Senate. It failed because of the pressure of the gun lobby. And then, thank heavens, the pressure of people started to be felt in Washington. In 6 months, we changed that vote and just passed, making it illegal to mail order mass murder techniques and implements, and the vote carried by 78 votes for it and a handful only against it. So you can bring about change when you listen. And I think the campuses have to do the same thing with our students. Cooperation can exist and must exist between students, faculty, and administrators. I think in most campus upsets since 1964, it's been shown that there was a lack of procedure and procedural rights which could have kept legitimate grievances within legitimate bounds. Administrative rulings, especially the assignment of guilt and punishment, I think should be subject to review. There should be procedures for hearings and appeals in which students would have a role. And I fought very hard on the floor of the Senate 3 weeks ago to not have the Senate of the United States and the Congress take on the disciplinary function that should be reserved to the faculty and the trustees and the governing bodies on our campuses. That cannot be stripped from you. But that disciplinary procedure must be followed, and our students must feel as though they have fair hearings. But then justice must follow, and it must follow just as swiftly as it possibly can in accordance with good procedures. I think increasingly we should have students be given a voice in matters concerning their education, their curriculum requirements, examination procedures, and even let them talk about and think out loud with us on the quality of teaching. I think if we listen to them, we can learn a great deal. I learn every single time I sit down with students. And I don't know how many hundreds of student groups I have met with. They're the highest priority I have. They not only have voting parents, but they also are some of the toughest audiences I have. We have seminars in my office. If the groups are too big, 200 and 300 sometimes on the Capitol steps. Question and answer sessions. I always learn as a result of meeting with the students from the state of Illinois. And I think we have to listen to them more as educators if we possibly can. And just look what's happening at the University of Oregon. 3 of the 12 members of a committee searching for a new university president are students. I think this is probably a pretty constructive stuff. The chairman of the Stanford Board of Trustees, where my daughter went and my son is now, recently said that he believes the time will come when boards of trustees will include ex officio members of both the Stanford faculty and the student body. Unlike many other universities, the alumni has always been represented on this great board, and other universities are now finding alumni and maybe next step student representation and faculty representation on the board would be a highly desirable thing. I think we do have to look at the social consequences of continuing student unrest. I think students might be less restless on campus if they felt their universities were somehow more relevant to society's immediate problems. They are deeply concerned at the preoccupation of many of our universities with military strategy and as contractors for the Defense Department and AEC and the space agency NASA, and they see more and more planes coming and going with distinguished professors that should be in there teaching classes, that find the glamour of Washington and serving on commissions and going out to foundations to get special grants to take them away from teaching assignments. They resent this. And I, for one, having been now in every single chair, I think I would say they've got a point that can well be made. Somehow we've degraded teaching and put it second, third, and fourth down the list of the important functions of many of our great schools and universities. And I think students are starting to bring us back to realize the highest and the best and the greatest profession of all must continue to be teaching. And if you're in research or you're doing things that are for, say, a governmental activity, you can't lose sight of the fact that teaching is the ultimate goal and aim and purpose of a great university. Alfred North Whitehead, however, once said that celibacy does not suit a university, and John Gardner really stated it even more directly. Universities have a stake in the health of their society. The problem is the students have seen it related to military strategy in Vietnam and not to the racial crisis and the urban crisis, the crisis of our cities and our rural communities that they feel are the more important things. In other words, they feel we've got to build America and this country and get back our morality here and our sense of values before we impose a way of life on some other culture. And if we'd listened to them probably years ago, we might not have gotten in the dilemma we are right now in Vietnam with an Americanized effort over there that seemingly is almost endless and doesn't exactly know where it's going after having been the longest war in American history. So that I'd say we can learn from students and by listening to them, and I think by opening our hearts and minds we can do it. Conclusion, I'd just like to say that I think universities are doing this. I know my own university of Chicago, with which I can deal a little more intimately, as a trustee for some 20 years now, we found that some trustees were proposing we move out of Chicago. We merge with a nice, quiet campus like, say, Northwestern, up in the suburbs where they have no problems, no trouble, no strife of any kind. And merge up there and move the campus up there and get out of this black ghetto that we found ourselves surrounded by. And thank heavens the university had the courage to say no. We've got to save the area lest it engulf the city as well as the great university. And a $500 million facility was saved by 15 to 20 years of hard work now in saving the South Side and making Woodlawn, Kenwood, one of the most exciting places to live now, I think you can, in an urban area. But also, it not only saved the community, the university is cut by means of Child Health Center, infant mortality to 50% that of other Chicago slums. It's taught mothers that old plaster peeled off walls, coated with lead paints, which causes child mental retardation. It's examined and in many cases treated the mental health of over 2,000 first graders alone on the south side of Chicago. It went out and struck out and attacked slumlords and ghetto people who were exploiting the ghetto dwellers, the vultures that had taken out of that society so much. It's given business training, advice, and help to ghetto residents who want to operate small businesses. In other words, it's become involved, and as it has, I think it has become more exciting to the students who've been involved in many of these projects. And my plea to my fellow associates in business of years past, you better get where the action is too. Don't leave it to government to save our cities, to find ways later to stop pollution. You better start stopping it right now before we pollute all the water and We drink in all the air we breathe. You better start getting a social conscience now. You better start helping us solve the problems of housing and slum and ghetto dwelling, hardcore unemployment. If you ever want to attract the bright people in this country again the way we used to 25 years ago in business, then 4 out of 5 college students wanted to go into businessmen. Today, 1 out of 5. They want to go into teaching, Peace Corps, government, politics. They want to be where the action is, and American business has to go where the action is. So we've got a challenging job ahead to keep up with our young people. I don't despair of our young America at all. No group of men and women would better know the young people of our state and other areas than you do. And I hope you share with me our confidence in the young people. They're high-minded. They have great integrity. Certainly there's a fringe element on the right and the left, as there is in every other segment of our American society. But for myself, I am filled with hope for this country and our future role of leadership in the world, because I'm filled with hope for the young people's ability to carry out some of the plans, hopes, and expectations. And I only hope the Congress of the United States and the institutions of education of this country are going to adapt our procedures rapidly enough to take advantage of this reservoir of goodwill that essentially exists in the young people of America.
Today, Professor Michael Sovereign, who is at a very early age one of the senior statesmen of Columbia University. He is a professor of law specializing in labor law. He has many academic distinctions and has worked considerably with major groups in the fields of labor law and civil rights. Through this faculty forum, his subject will be student disorders, university reform, and our legal system.
Thank you, Vic. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I arrived yesterday and said yesterday afternoon many of the things I shall say today, and I'm reminded of the fact that the circumstances at Columbia being what they have been, I've spent a considerable amount of time speaking at Columbia and often repeating myself, and I can't help thinking today, as I'm about to repeat some of the things I said yesterday, of a bumbling, well-meaning colleague who came up to me one day and said, "You know, I've heard you make that speech 4 times, and I want to tell you that each time you're better than the next." There is, as you are no doubt aware, a great sense of comparativeness in universities today. We're all collecting each other's experiences and seeing how others are dealing with the same problems we face from one place to another. I had a refreshing report from a colleague of mine who's just back from a year in India, and he tells me that the students there are much more respectful than ours, indeed reverential, and often address their teachers as father. And we're almost there at Columbia. They call us mother. We had our first anniversary this week. Wednesday, the 23rd, was the first anniversary of the occupation of Hamilton Hall last year, and I'm delighted to report to you that yesterday morning at our regular 8:30 bunker conference, somebody said, "What is SDS doing?" And the delightful quality of that struck us, that the day after the first anniversary, which we feared would be a festive occasion, we didn't know where they were. We had no idea. Campus has been quiet. We've had a sit-in or two, but that's a regular state of affairs. We've had no violence, and we've had no protracted disturbances at Columbia this spring, or indeed at any point since last spring's affair. So that, while God only knows what's happening back there at the moment, the indications are that one can climb out of the kind of mess we had in the spring with some a great outpouring of energy by faculty and students who are concerned with these matters. And what I'd like to do today is use us, Columbia, as something of a case study. I am struck, the more time I spend with academics from other universities, at the similarity of the problems. The solutions called for may well be different depending on local circumstances, but the problems seem to be almost identical from campus to campus, with the forms changing a bit, the solutions sometimes changing, but the challenges that confront us are essentially the same. And in making a diagnosis of what is going on, I start, I think rightly, outside the university with the pervasive conditions that are troubling our students today, and those conditions are best captured for me by a brief television episode that occurred last August when Columbia replaced Grayson Kirk with Andrew Corger, and the television stations were on force. Nobody at Columbia goes anywhere without at least three television cameras trailing him. And there they were. They devoted 3 or 4 seconds to the changing of the regime, and then out into the street to interview some radicals, which follow the cameramen. And they had a willing subject, and they said to this fellow, what do you think of the substitution of Dr. Corger for Dr. Kirk? And he said, no change. Said, well, what do you think would be meaningful change at Columbia? He said, an end to the Vietnam War and a real poverty program. Now, the first reaction to that is to think that he's out of touch, but that's a very instructive response, because I submit to you that every campus that's been disrupted has been disrupted over one of those issues, often both. The presence of the issue may be symbolic, but if you look at the ROTC, that problem is everywhere. That's obviously doesn't have to do simply with whether students engage in drill once a week. It has to do with the Vietnam War. We haven't experienced the kind of resentment of that particular program and the sudden purity about academic purpose since the 30s. You remember in the Korean War, there was no suggestion that the Navy or the Air Force or the Army shouldn't be marching up and down the local athletic field. Indeed, we regarded it as a useful kind of scholarship supplement. But today it becomes a matter of high principle that the university not be in that kind of relationship with the United States government. I suggest to you that's not explicable in terms that don't take the Vietnam War and the draft and foreign policy into account. And similarly, the brouhaha over black studies and a variety of concerns with university expansion into the community, Columbia, Chicago, Cambridge, these are manifestations of concern over race relations, in which the university is often a surrogate for the society at large in the eyes of the student. So I start there because it seems to me one needs to have a realistic appraisal of what's going on if one is going to do something about it. I don't mean to suggest that we are helpless or that the universities themselves have not done things or failed to do things that contribute to our own difficulties. I thought I might tick off a little agenda of unsolved problems at the higher education that to more or less degree feed into these extrinsic concerns and cause our students to feel a sense of alienation and disaffection to a degree sufficient to lead to mammoth disorders at many institutions. And I start, of course, at the center of affairs with the quality of education in American universities today, and cannot help a sense of a pride that we do as much as we do, but also a sense of grave dissatisfaction with the many things we leave undone and our failure to move forward in educational innovation at a pace that's commensurate with our capacities and the needs. I think of the undergraduates at Columbia College today. I suspect that's my experience with them is parallel to a great many other places, where when I was a freshman at Columbia College, I found many of the programs thrilling, exciting. They've had it before. As bad as American public education is in many respects, the finest secondary schools have made major changes in their curriculum and indeed have very nearly usurped the freshman and sometimes sophomore years of even the best universities, and we've done too little to take account of this and to do something about making educational changes so that instead of having bright-eyed, thrilled freshmen, we have jaded students whose sense is that they're the victims of a hoax. They came to the university expecting something new and exciting, and they're getting something that's often less than what they had before, since they're frequently trained by inexperienced instructors whose main concern is with getting their doctorate or advancing in the department, and whose teaching often leaves something to be desired. At the graduate level, I think, for the most part, we still look pretty much the way the German universities did a century ago. It may be that they had found the best way of training for the academy and the professions, but I doubt it. I suspect we've learned something in the century that's intervened, but too little of what we've learned is reflected in our arrangements. And we have a great many graduate students who feel a sense of exploitation. That is to say, their seniors commonly use them in seminars and use some of their work in their own work. And often a sense of victimization. That is to say, what they really want to do is teach and do their own research free of supervision, and in fact, they can't do that until they get the PhD. I don't mean to suggest that all their grievances are justified or that there aren't a great many brilliant, exciting teachers at both the undergraduate and graduate level, but as in any other enterprise, there are a great many who are not brilliant and exciting, and our students are quite aware of this and perplexed and resentful of it. There is, in addition, a tradition of university management that is self-defeating. We're all, and I include myself in this, committed to the proposition that academic administration should be the work of academics. That is to say, the president of a university should be a teacher and a scholar, so should everybody else who counts in a large way in the management of the institution. And yet, if you think about it, that's an impossible goal to sustain. If we're going to have any depth in administration, think about why it is you came to the academy, and with more or less degree of self-awareness, you came to, I came because I like to teach, I enjoy scholarship, I like the people one finds in a university. It's fun to be respected by and share one's lunch hours and cocktail time with the people whose main concern is with ideas. Sometimes it's kind of nice just to hide out from the rest of the world. I like to have an occasional summer off. None of those reasons is satisfied if you choose to become an administrator. You can't teach. You don't get time to write. The people you came there to be with look down on you. I think it's no accident that literally hundreds of college presidencies and deanships are vacant at the moment. I have a thought about how one might deal with that problem, and I want to come to a bit later. But I do think it's critical to recognize that the universities, contrary to the common student rhetoric, that there's too much administration, there's not nearly enough because of the way we structure the recruitment process of administrators. And the result is that a great many problems are never attended to. The administrator is a fireman who rushes from one crisis to another and is incapable of devoting consecutive thought to the planning and functioning of his institution on a long-term basis. Then we have, I think, probably greater than any time in the past, a serious lack of consensus over the purposes of the university. There's always been tension, I'm sure, about what it is the university is about, but I suspect never so much so as at present. The pressure on the part of students to make universities social service institutions, indeed, that pressure is often, well, that sense of purpose is often shared by some faculty. There's a deterioration of the commitment to the central missions of the university, teaching and research, to a degree greater than any I think we've experienced before. One contributing cause, in my judgment, is the number of people who are in a university even though they don't want to be. Particularly because of the draft, we have a great many undergraduates who are in the university studying when they'd really rather be out organizing farm workers or engaging in other enterprises that their idealism would lead them to. But they can't do that. It's the university or the army. And so you go to the university, and if you're sincere about your commitment, then you try and get the university to do that which you wanted to do yourself. And so every urban university is under pressure to maintain mammoth social service programs for the ghetto. You have a wide variety of causes that students and some faculty, some students, some faculty, wish to see the university serve. Great resentment on the part of other faculty of the distraction from what they take to be the main concerns. And you can see how, with both groups feeling deeply and warmly about the particular position they take, that you very quickly get in a position of polarization if you're not careful to keep the lines of communication wide open. So I mentioned the problems of the quality of education, undermanned administrations, lack of consensus over the purposes of the university. Then I come to a point of particular importance in our experience at Columbia that I think is generally valid, and that is that the lack of student participation in the decision-making processes of the university has been a critical factor in their disaffection in numbers large enough to cause places to be effectively shut down. What happens is that students who do not share in the making of an institution's decisions feel that there is no alternative to change but disruption, that there are no open roads, no legitimate channels of reform, and so in order to make the university sit up, take notice, and reform itself, they have no recourse but to coercive tactics. And that's one of the most difficult points to grapple with when one comes to talk to students, and as they must, you know, given the state of higher education in any institution, they will find things wrong with it. And they will say, well, what do you suggest we do to get it changed? And you suggest, well, why don't you communicate your sense? And they say, we tried to. They wouldn't see us. They didn't answer our letters. And by God, this way we got action. The number of students who have said to me, well, would Columbia have been reformed if we didn't take a building, is legion. And so any recipe or formula for the avoidance of disruption seems to me must include a structure for orderly reform within the institution. Then the final factor I would note, and I'm obviously not trying to be comprehensive, I just want to pick a few causes that seem to me to be of greatest importance. The final factor I would note is the reluctance on the part of many faculty to discipline students who disrupt. I suspect this reluctance is related to the previous point, that is to say they share the sense that the students had no alternative. But there is a pervasive unwillingness on the part of faculty to apply the sanctions of the social order to their own students. And what this has, what has happened time and time again is that the intra-university procedures lose their credibility. The students do a rough calculation. They aren't going to expel 500 of us, so if we got 500, we can do almost anything we want. Extra-university sanctions have traditionally involved the use of the police, but that's a not only highly controversial, highly dangerous response given the incidence of police violence when they're utilized to clear large numbers of persons. And if there's any lesson that one can learn from the pattern of response at our great universities, it has been that when the police brutalize students, the university falls apart. Berkeley was first, we were second, and now Harvard, and I'm sure there are lots of others that haven't been nearly so well publicized. It is both our to our credit and to some degree, I suppose, to our discredit, that we cannot stand the sight of blood. I use an electric shaver. And so with faculty reluctance to impose sanctions intra-university, the extra-university sanction of police being a far too dangerous gambit for most institutions, in the casting about, we've successfully at Columbia twice used the injunctive procedures of the courts, a device that I believe was first used at Howard University with success, again at Buffalo, and now most recently twice at Columbia. Other institutions are in the process of resorting to similar court relief. I'm not at all sure how long it will work. There's a quality of the emperor's clothes about the injunction. If anybody notices how naked the judicial power is, it may lose its interorum effect, and we'll be back without any sanctions. Now, what have we done at Columbia in the effort to meet these problems? The most important thing we've done, in my judgment, is to concentrate on the creation of institutions for orderly change with students given a large role in those institutions. We've overwhelmingly agreed, that is to say, the faculty, students, that the university cannot be a place that treats students as customers who should be told to go shop elsewhere if they don't like what they find. Students live in the university for many years. It shapes their careers. It's their means of participation in our society in a professional way. To treat it as some transient, trivial relationship is a serious mistake, and neither wise nor prudent for any university to behave that way. There is, moreover, we have general agreement, something to be said educationally for student participation in the roles of government in a university. I'm something of a jingoist about legal education. I've always thought that one of its great contributions to pedagogy was its insistence that students grapple with real problems. That is to say, we put cases to them with as much verisimilitude as we can manage within the halls of the academy, and insist that they face up to the fact that any important decision involves the sacrifice of competing values and real losses, that the decision-making process is one that involves selection among competing goods and not simply getting everything you want. And if anything, it seems to me, has characterized the behavior of students at many institutions, it has been the lack of awareness of this central feature of decision-making. That is to say, the university makes a decision, and they say, well, look what you did. You've raised tuition, for example. Now, poor people won't be able to come. And you point out, well, if you didn't raise tuition, perhaps nobody would come. Whatever decision it is, an institution makes one, it is going to make some people unhappy. If the students are excluded from the decision-making process, they are perforce, or almost perforce, excluded from the informational process, so they're not aware of all the factors that went into the decision. They are not committed to the decision, and they are not forced to the discipline of choice, and it would be well for their education if they were. What we've recommended at Columbia and will soon have is a university senate as the governing body of the institution, subordinate to the board of trustees, but in the same way that any university is subordinate to the trustees. That is to say, they have the residual power, but the effective operating responsibility will be in the senate. And 21 seats in this 100-man senate will be allocated to student representatives, elected student representatives, who will be full members of the body. The advantages we perceive from this are several, and let me go back now to the shortcomings that I ticked off within the university. You remember I noted some doubts about the quality of education. One of the reasons I suspect we have not done better in advancing education at the same pace that other sectors of society have advanced is that we are so peculiarly sheltered from the judgments of the consumer. Education is the only service I know of where we take it as presumptively true that the customer is always wrong. You think of any other product or service in our society, it's subject to market competition, or it's subject to government regulation, or it's subject at least to the consumer's desire to chance to dispense with it. But that's not true of higher education. There's no real competition for the students in the sense of having enough to run the place. Sure, one institution will get better students than another, but students, anybody who wants to be a lawyer, a doctor, a professor, or any number of other things, has to go to the university. And of course, we regard government regulation as the essence of outrage. And given that kind of invulnerability to judgments of what we do, I suspect we have done less well than we otherwise might. In addition to being the only service that's immune in that way, it's worth noting that we're also the only service that the customer, having paid for it, is perfectly willing to dispense with. I'll confess to you, if you'll confess to me, that when I announce that I'm going to be unable to meet a class, my students cheer. I remind them, Columbia is a private institution, of course, I remind them their tuition rates are such that for each class hour of mine they attend, they pay roughly what they'd pay to see a Broadway show. That doesn't make any difference. They're delighted. They're delighted to do without it. As I say, one of the gains we look for from all of this is an improvement in the education of our students, because we will be forced to listen to them in ways that I suspect we have not always before. And I don't want to sell us short. I think many of us, indeed perhaps most of us, have always been receptive to students, responsive to them, warm towards them. But we know what's best, is our essential stance. At least I'll confess to having generally followed that attitude. And sometimes we've been wrong. To admit them to the process of decision-making, I think, will require us to pay attention to students in a way that we have not before. And this, I would hope, would lead us to better instruction and, at the same time, perhaps to a more effective working consensus on the goals of the university, so that we can make judgments about where we're going with some kind of agreement as to what the idea and ideal of the university is and should be. Then, of course, by admitting students to the decision-making process, one can fairly demand, and I think fairly expect, a commitment to that process by the students in a way that will minimize the chances of disruption. Obviously, there is no formula for guaranteeing a quiet campus, but I think our students are sufficiently wise and receptive so that when one points out to them that if you participate in the decision-making process, you must, as part of human decency and commitment to the democratic ethos, agree to abide by those decisions. And you cannot claim a share in decision-making power at the same time claim complete freedom to resort to coercion when those decisions don't please you. And having had a great many conversations with students on this subject over the past year, I'm convinced that many, many will be moved by that. At the same time, I would suppose that the faculty tolerance for the use of coercion by students will be diminished by this kind of process, so that when students, having been admitted to the decision-making apparatus, nonetheless insist that they're going to have their way, I suspect our patience will run a lot thinner, and that we will be willing to impose sanctions against students when we should, and with some vigor. Even the appearance of that will obviously have a deterring effect on students who would otherwise try and tear us apart. Then on this business of filling the ranks of administration, one of the byproducts that we've just stumbled on this past year at Columbia is that when you get faculty involvement at a high level of decision-making and with some intensity of spirit, what you've done is, in effect, gotten yourself a citizen's army of administrators. So that although I've taught my regular classes this year, I haven't written a line worth publishing. That hasn't stopped me from publishing some of it. But in effect, I've been a part-time administrator, as have the other members of the executive committee. And what's happened is that we've thought about and concerned ourselves with a great many problems that would not otherwise have been attended to at all. And occasionally, we've even done what would normally be administrative chores. And particularly at the level of handling student problems, as you know, faculty have, in most places, I think, far greater rapport with students than administrators. The students tend to trust us, to mistrust the administrators, so that we have, in the circumstances of Columbia, done some of the things administrators otherwise have done. For example, I've been the chief figure for the faculty, and since the administration left it to us, for the university in four sit-ins. I'm happy to report that they all ended peacefully and relatively quickly. Well, you multiply that, and I've had other colleagues who've taken care of different problems. We have 20 men on the executive committee, and they've all given quite substantially of their time. Indeed, the response to the call of our school was really quite exciting. All over the campus, at the divisional level, at the central level, the turnout of faculty members with all their hearts was really quite thrilling. I don't mean to be maudlin about it, but it does give great hope for the willingness of faculty to assume the burdens of citizenship within their academic community in a way that I suspect we have not done before. Nobody asked us to before may be the reason. We didn't perceive the need for it before. But in short, the point I want to make about that is that there may be here adventitiously a solution to the problem of how you get the work of the university, the administrative aspects of the university's affairs taken care of. And it may be that faculty members who are unwilling to lay down their books to accept vice presidencies and deanships will nonetheless accept committee chairmanships, which permit them to continue to function as teachers and scholars for the most part. I should tell you that we submitted our Senate proposal. The proposal was the recommendation of the executive committee. We submitted it to polls of students and faculty just last month and received extraordinarily high turnouts for university elections. 65% of the tenured faculty voted, about 43% of non-tenured faculty, and roughly the same proportion of students. And in each category, we received a 90% yes vote. So that our faculty is reconciled to having roughly 20% of students in its governing body, and our students are willing to accept that proportion as the basis, at least for a beginning, in this new kind of governing institution. Let me say just a few things more of a general sort, and then I understand I'm to sit down and let some of you leave and then try and answer any questions you have. The Chinese are the subject of much of our learning these days, and rather than direct you to anything from the sayings of Chairman Mao, let me pass along a bit of cultural linguistics that I acquired. The Chinese word crisis consists of two characters, one of which represents danger and one of which represents opportunity. And this seems to me defines the present state of the American university. What's the danger? The danger, it seems to me, was beautifully captured by George Orwell some years ago. I quote from him, "The thing that frightens me about the modern intelligentsia is their inability to see that human society must be based on common decency, whatever the political and economic forms may be." And I suggest to you the danger is that we are taking incivility and inhumanity for granted, that our threshold of outrage at inhumanity to one another has been rising much too high. Now, obviously, the response is not repression. Now, that's just as inhumane. But I take it we have to have recourse to our faith in education. And I do believe that we in the universities must do better on two critical fronts. One is where change is called for, as I think it is in the universities, we have to help our colleagues and others in our society to be responsive to it, to be open to change, so that when just reforms are urged, those who urge them are not left with disorder as the only means of bringing about change. And then at the same time, we must teach those who regard the tactic of disruption as something to be used indiscriminately and with little care, that it does erode our humanity. And those who will not learn that disorder is destructive to everything we care about, I think we must have the stomach to discipline. What are the opportunities? They seem to me to be captured in the under the general category of the opportunity for a deeper, richer educational experience, not only for the students, but for ourselves. This has been, for me, an incredibly instructive year. I've spent literally hundreds of hours with student leaders of one stamp and another, and have learned from them. And I suspect that all of us still have something to learn. Without being at all romantic about youth, they do have perceptions that we have sometimes forgotten, and that sometimes it's profitable to listen to them. So the Chinese character for crisis, a kind of Janus face, danger, opportunity, defines, I think, what ought to be our two central objectives. We must maintain academic freedom in what will almost certainly be intensified attacks on it from both within and without the university. I think we would be foolish to believe that this spring or next spring we'll see the end of disruption on the campuses. The very best we can hope for is a modest state of guerrilla warfare for the foreseeable future. And that, of course, is going to excite all kinds of outside influences in the contrary direction. And we're going to have to stand quite often, I fear, and maintain our civility and civilization. And at the same time, I think we must improve the quality of university life, both in its educational and its decision-making aspects. And it's in that spirit and in that hope that at Columbia we are attempting our new institution, the Student Faculty Senate. Thank you.